Syria was the latest challenge to the White House by congressional Democrats who are taking a more assertive role in influencing policy in the Middle East and the Iraq War. President Bush was none too happy. Bush has said Pelosi's trip signals that the Assad government is part of the international mainstream when it is not. The United States says Syria allows Iraqi Sunni insurgents to operate from its territory, backs the Hezbollah and Hamas militant groups, and is trying to destabilize the Lebanese government. Syria denies the allegations. The Associated Press understated Syria's brutal offenses. As columnist Tom Rogan wrote in National Review, between 2005 and 2008, foreign jihadists flooded along the arterial highways that connect eastern Syria and western Iraq. Once in Iraq, they joined up with facilitators from the Islamic State's precursor Al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI. The zealots were then assigned to murder American soldiers and Marines, and AQI was responsible for particularly gruesome crimes. But it wasn't just AQI that received Assad's support. A long-term ally of Iranian intelligence and the Lebanese Hezbollah, Assad's regime harbored those waging explosively formed penetrator, EFP, terrorism against U.S. military patrols in Iraq and power drill wars against the heads of innocent Sunnis. Again, the facts are clear. When the CIA finally caught up with Imad Mughniya, a key organizer of these attacks, in February 2008, he was in Damascus. Think on that. Nearly a year after Pelosi's peace visit, Assad was still protecting this murderer as he lived openly. As Speaker, Pelosi would have known this and much more. But Pelosi was not the first Democratic House Speaker to try to subvert a Republican president's foreign policy this way. The late Jim Wright had taken it upon himself to lead negotiations among the various factions in Nicaragua, including the communist regime led by strongman Daniel Ortega, in contravention of President Ronald Reagan's policy. On November 17, 1987, the Los Angeles Times reported that President Reagan personally admonished House Speaker Jim Wright for talking with Nicaraguan leaders, but Wright left the meeting unapologetic for the unorthodox role that he is playing in the Central America peace negotiations. The Times added, "The standoff between Reagan and Wright is certain to complicate the task of State Department officials assigned to carry out U.S. policy in Central America. Wright's continued participation also will serve to bring additional pressure on the administration to talk with the Sandinista government in a bilateral setting." In a meeting at the White House with President Reagan and his top foreign policy team, Reagan spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that the president told Wright he disapproves of the meetings between the speaker and Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega late last week at a time when administration officials are refusing to talk to Ortega. Fitzwater said that Reagan, who has long supported the Contras' effort to overthrow the Sandinistas, told the speaker that by injecting himself into the middle of the Nicaraguan peace talks, he is getting involved in what should be essentially a matter between the Sandinista government and the Nicaraguan resistance. Indeed, after the meeting, Wright insisted that he still intends to continue meeting with Central American leaders and will make a trip to Costa Rica on December 1st. Again, there was not much uproar in the Democratic Party press about this or other instances of collusion and open interference by Democrats with the foreign policies of past Republican administrations. Certainly the mass media did not prod for or demand criminal investigations or a political reckoning against any of these Democratic Party actors. Compare these multiple events, all involving Democratic officials, with the press treatment of President Trump. Abuse of power. Newsrooms and editorial pages insist that President Trump is frequently and relentlessly abusing power in more ways than one can count or categorize. By way of news reports, news analysis, news interpretation, news roundtables, expert commentary, and clear-cut propaganda, the public is served by the Democratic Party press a daily dose of President Trump's alleged criminal violations, legal violations, ethics violations, norm violations, unprecedented actions, bullying, threatening, etc., suggesting or asserting that Trump is a tyrant or would-be tyrant. A typical example. Huffington Post contributor Philip Rotner proclaimed on July 27, 2017, only 6 months into the Trump presidency, that Donald Trump is using the bully pulpit of the presidency, emphasis on bully, to politicize the criminal justice system, punish politicians who won't toe his line, and humiliate private citizens who dare to speak out against him. Whether Trump's abuse of power is criminal or only dangerously unethical probably depends on whether he has crossed the line into criminal obstruction of justice. That judgment will be made by special counsel Robert Mueller, assuming that Mueller will be allowed to complete his investigation. Of course, Mueller did finish his investigation, and there was no criminal obstruction of justice. Rotner later declared that neither criminal accountability nor the prospect of impeachment takes the full measure of Trump's abuse of power. More important is the damage Trump is inflicting upon the rule of law, separation of powers, and the checks and balances that protect our democracy. Rotner's wildly absurd and hysterical assertions are not uncommon among those who work in America's newsrooms. The mass media's coverage of Donald Trump treats as a given that he is a power-hungry lawbreaker. But to what end is he supposedly so inclined? He has not financially enriched himself as president. On the contrary, he left a lucrative business career to run and then serve in public office, and donates his presidential salary to the government and charities. He is not an ideologue who seeks to fundamentally transform America into something it is not, and against the public's will, as Barack Obama openly proclaimed, or like Senator Bernie Sanders and other Democratic candidates seeking the presidency have declared. Indeed, his policy initiatives range from mainstream conservative to even center-left in some cases, such as so-called prison reform, trade tariffs imposed on allies, price controls on domestically produced drugs, paid family leave, etc. He has not assumed or exercised presidential powers in some extraordinary way despite, for example, efforts to falsely characterize his use of the National Emergencies Act of 1976 and the funding of physical barriers on the southern border as such. The president has both legal and budgetary congressional authorization to act. An examination of news reporting and media commentary over a score of months demonstrates that many of the president's statements, decisions, and actions are met with a predictable and knee-jerk chorus of media excoriations and allegations. However, it seemed at one point that President Trump's firing of former FBI Director James Comey, whose resignation or removal Democratic officials and the Democratic Party press had earlier demanded, turned out to be an especially traumatizing event for the mass media, or, more accurately, an opportunity for them to crystallize their loathing for the president around a set of accusations, such as constitutional crisis, obstruction of justice, and cover-up, which, they hoped, would lead to his political and legal undoing. The Washington Free Beacon observed that Comey's dismissal drew accusations that Trump was trying to cover up the federal investigation into alleged collusion between his presidential campaign and the Russians in 2016. CNN legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin said the firing was a grotesque abuse of power by Trump and was the sort of thing that happens in non-democracies. Fellow CNN analyst David Gregory said Trump's actions and the subsequent White House spin demonstrated disdain for the presidency. The Free Beacon also reported that MSNBC host Chris Matthews called it the Tuesday Night Massacre, a reference to the Saturday Night Massacre when Richard Nixon ordered the firing of Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox in 1973. He later added Trump's actions had the whiff of fascism to them. One of the reporters who broke the Watergate scandal, Carl Bernstein, said on CNN that the dismissal marked a terribly dangerous moment in American history. Moreover, ABC's Cokie Roberts said the Watergate comparisons were understandable, and MSNBC host Joe Scarborough said that the echoes of Watergate were filling Washington, D.C. The question this morning is whether the centuries-old system of checks and balances will swing into action, he said. What was missing from most of these reports was accuracy and context. There were many good and legitimate reasons for Comey's firing, and many Democrats had been on record denouncing him. For example, on November 2, 2016, Bloomberg News reported, Senator Charles Schumer is joining a growing chorus of criticism over FBI Director James Comey's decision to alert lawmakers to new emails potentially linked to the Bureau's investigation into Hillary Clinton's private server. I do not have confidence in him any longer, Schumer told Bloomberg News. On January 13, 2017, in a story headlined, Tensions Boil Up Between Democrats and FBI Director, CBS News reported that Democrats stormed out of a briefing on Russian hacking, furious with one of the briefers, Comey. The FBI director has no credibility, said Representative Maxine Waters of California. My confidence in the FBI director's ability to lead this agency has been shaken, said Representative Hank Johnson of Georgia. Furthermore, on May 9, 2017, then-Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein set forth in a detailed memorandum titled Restoring Public Confidence in the FBI the reasons he and the Department of Justice had lost faith in Comey and the basis for his firing. Among other things, Rosenstein wrote, "Although the president has the power to remove the FBI director, the decision should not be taken lightly. I agree with the nearly unanimous opinions of former department officials. The way the director handled the conclusion of the Hillary Clinton email investigation was wrong. As a result, the FBI is unlikely to gain public and congressional trust until it has a director who understands the gravity of the mistakes and pledges never to repeat them. Having refused to admit his errors, the director cannot be expected to implement the necessary corrective actions." In fact, shortly after his firing, Comey stated in a letter to all that, "I have long believed that a president can fire an FBI director for any reason or no reason at all. I am not going to spend time on the decision or the way it was executed." Of course, a disgruntled Comey has never stopped criticizing the president for his removal, but at the time he understood it to be a perfectly legitimate and legal presidential act. Notwithstanding that the Russia investigation was never hampered in any way during or after Comey's firing, the president did nothing to limit its reach or funding. The Trump's abuse of power narrative persists in the media. However, the fact is that the Trump administration's use of executive power has hardly been abusive. Indeed, it has been unexceptional and even tame. Again, perspective and context are important given how reporters cover the president today. Hence, a brief look at history is warranted. For example, David Burnham, formerly a New York Times investigative reporter, in 1989 authored the book A Law Unto Itself, in which he provides numerous accounts and extensive evidence of, among other things, the use of the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, to target political opponents, both individuals and organizations, by past presidents and administrations. Take the presidency of the much-celebrated great progressive Franklin Roosevelt. Burnham writes that confidential government documents prove that Roosevelt and the officials around him did not hesitate to mobilize the IRS in efforts to destroy the careers of individuals they had decided were enemies. The records even show that on one occasion, an inquiry from Eleanor Roosevelt prompted Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau to order a tax investigation of a conservative newspaper publisher who had become one of the Roosevelt administration's leading critics. Roosevelt was particularly hostile toward Andrew Mellon, a former Republican Treasury Secretary and successful businessman. Probably the single most brazen display of the Roosevelt administration's willingness to use the tax agency for political purposes, declares Burnham, was its attack on Andrew Mellon, the millionaire capitalist who served as the Republican Secretary of the Treasury from 1921 to 1932. Elmer L. Irie, the first director of what is now called the Criminal Investigation Division, acknowledged that Treasury Secretary Morgenthau ordered him to develop serious tax charges against Mellon, even though he knew that the just-retired Treasury Secretary was innocent. It seems unlikely that Morgenthau would have mounted such a campaign without the approval of FDR. Mellon was harassed for years with false charge after false charge filed against him. In the end, all criminal and civil fraud penalties the Roosevelt administration had brought against him were dismissed. Burnham explains that Roosevelt was a driven man who did not hesitate to adopt questionable tactics to maintain his power. The Mellon case was hardly the only occasion on which the Roosevelt administration mobilized the tax agency for political purposes. From his very first moments as the Democratic presidential candidate in 1931, for example, Roosevelt had understood that Huey Long represented a genuine political threat. The administration's deep concern about Long was translated into action exactly 3 days after Morgenthau became Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary, when Morgenthau ordered Irie, the man he had instructed to go after Mellon, to launch a second campaign against Long. Just how important the Long case had become to the Roosevelt administration, wrote Burnham, is indicated by the direct involvement of the president in an important last-minute aspect of the effort to crush Long, the selection and recruiting of a lawyer to handle the actual prosecution. The story of FDR's direct intervention in the case was told by Irie. The investigation effectively ended when Long was assassinated and died on September 10, 1935. According to former Hillsdale College professor Burton Folsom, Jr., Roosevelt marveled at the potential of the IRS for removing political opponents. Newspaper publisher William Randolph Hearst also found himself under investigation when he began opposing Roosevelt's political programs. In fact, as Burnham recounts, Eleanor Roosevelt sicked the IRS on conservative newspaper publisher Frank Gannett, who at the time was also vice chairman of the Republican National Committee. Hearst and Gannett were not the only newspaper publishers the Roosevelt targeted. Moses Moe Annenberg also drew an IRS audit with 35 agents working for 2.5 years to prosecute him, explains Folsom. Annenberg had just bought the Philadelphia Inquirer, which would become hostile to Roosevelt's agenda. Annenberg quickly became immersed in Republican politics, writing against the New Deal in general and competing against the Philadelphia Record in particular. David Stern was the editor of the Philadelphia Record, and Stern enjoyed playing chess with Morgenthau and high-stakes politics with Roosevelt, who appreciated Stern's successful efforts to elect more Democrats in Pennsylvania. Annenberg's conservative politics and his entrepreneurial spirit made him an effective Republican competitor in the newspaper and political wars. Annenberg's aggressive advertising and news reporting helped the Inquirer sharply increase its subscriptions and sales and helped cause Stern's Record to decline in sales and market share. On the political side, that meant more readers were absorbing Annenberg's pungent editorials against the New Deal in general and Roosevelt in particular. What made things so awful for Stern, Roosevelt, and the Pennsylvania Democrats was that Annenberg was selling his ideas effectively, making money for the Inquirer, and helping lead the Republicans to a stunning victory in the 1938 midterm election. Stern was losing money at the Record, and he turned to the government for help. In desperation, for example, he was able to get the Federal Trade Commission to prosecute Annenberg for selling advertising at rates too low. The Roosevelt administration had a better idea. An IRS investigation of Moe Annenberg. Unlike Mellon, who as Secretary of Treasury knew tax law inside out, Annenberg was careless and paid little attention to his taxes. After the massive investigation was completed, it was determined that Annenberg owed the federal government $8 million, which he offered to pay with fines and penalties. But Roosevelt wanted Annenberg imprisoned. As Irie told Morgenthau, they are not going to have the opportunity to pay the tax and avoid prison. When Morgenthau and Roosevelt had lunch over the matter on April 11, 1939, Morgenthau asked Roosevelt if he could do something for the president. "Yes," Roosevelt said, "I want Moe Annenberg for dinner." Morgenthau responded, "You're going to have him for breakfast, fried." The goal was to remove the Inquirer's owner as a political influence in the state by putting him in prison and end the Inquirer's harsh criticism of Roosevelt's policies. It worked. Folsom also describes how Roosevelt intervened in investigations to protect his political allies. For example, writes Folsom, Frank Haig was the undisputed boss of Jersey City. He initially backed Al Smith for president in 1932, but quickly shifted to Roosevelt after the Democratic convention. Haig promised the swing state of New Jersey to Roosevelt and gave the future president a spectacular parade with 100,000 present in Seagirt, New Jersey, the largest Roosevelt saw anywhere during the entire campaign. Haig used his patronage wisely and controlled his city with an iron hand. Even with the torrent of federal funds cascading into New Jersey and charges of corruption rampant, the IRS never made a serious investigation of Haig. Nonetheless, the time came when Haig needed Roosevelt's intervention, and he got it. Folsom explains that Roosevelt was embarrassed by Haig and never included him in his inner circle, but Haig was needed if New Jersey was to remain in the president's column. Roosevelt was firm on that and proved it when James Farley discovered Haig had a crony at the post office who was opening and reading all mail to and from major political opponents. Tampering with the U.S. mail was a federal offense, and some of Huey Long's henchmen went to jail for misusing the post office. Farley, in fact, came to Roosevelt for instructions on how to prosecute Haig. The president, however, stopped Farley in his tracks. "Forget prosecution. You go tell Frank to knock it off. We can't have this kind of thing going on, but keep this quiet. We need Haig's support if we want New Jersey." Roosevelt helped a loyal Texas congressman by the name of Lyndon Johnson. Johnson himself became an IRS target for failing to properly report income from his campaigns, explains Folsom. On January 13, 1944, just as six IRS agents were winding up their 18-month investigation of Johnson, President Roosevelt had an emergency meeting with Johnson. That day, the president contacted IRE and began the process of halting the investigation of Johnson. Johnson was not harmed at all. He had proven himself too valuable to the president to lose. The Kennedy administration was also notorious for misusing confidential IRS and FBI information, as well as authorizing the FBI to spy on Martin Luther King Jr. Recall earlier what Jeff Himmelman revealed in his book about Ben Bradley, Yours in Truth, when Pierre Salinger, Kennedy's press secretary, negotiated to have Ben Bradley come up to Newport, Rhode Island, where Jackie's family had an enormous waterfront estate, Hammersmith Farm, to review FBI files that would prove that organizations spreading the rumors about Kennedy were shady themselves. This would discredit the opposition and advance a storyline that the administration wanted to advance. In his own book, Conversations with Kennedy, Bradley writes that we, President Kennedy and Bradley, talked about taxes and who pays how much. The president stunned us all by saying that J. Paul Getty, the oil zillionaire who was reputedly the richest man in the world, paid exactly $500 in income taxes last year, and that H. L. Hunt, the Texas oil zillionaire, who must be one of the next richest, paid only $22,000 in income taxes last year. He said I asked him, since he had obviously done some research on the tax payments of millionaires, how much Daniel Ludwig had paid, referring back to the owner of the yacht that had failed to salute the commander-in-chief last month in Newport. He smiled, but he didn't bite, and then said that all this tax information was secret, and it was probably illegal for him to know, or at least for him to tell me. I told him if he ever wanted to give a tax reform bill the last little push, all he had to do was let me publish this kind of information. Burnham explains further that there was a regular process in place for the White House to receive confidential IRS information. On May 23, 1961, Mortimer M. Kaplan, then serving as Kennedy's brand new IRS commissioner, had written a long memorandum explaining that a few months before he had allowed Carmine Bellino, a special consultant to President Kennedy, to inspect IRS files without a written request. Vernon Mike Acree, an IRS official, explained, "Right after Kennedy was elected, I got called down to Kaplan's office. He introduced me to Bellino. Kaplan said Bellino was a special assistant to the president and could have anything. One of my assistants set Bellino up in a little office in the IRS headquarters building. I remember that one day during the Kennedy years that my assistant provided Bellino a stack of tax records about 10 inches high that had been submitted by the New York Times. We weren't told why the White House wanted to see the Times returns and didn't ask. The tax information I made available to Kennedy and Nixon was not unusual." Acree added, "I had provided the same service to the White House people under Truman, Eisenhower, and Johnson." Furthermore, after being nudged by President Kennedy and with his knowledge and that of Attorney General Robert Kennedy, Kaplan instituted an audit program aimed at groups on the right that were critical of the president and his policies. In April 1976, the Senate Select Intelligence Committee reported, "By directing tax audits at individuals and groups solely because of their political beliefs, the Ideological Organization's Audit Project, as the 1961 Kennedy program was known, established a precedent for a far more elaborate program of targeting dissidents." The abuses also reached into the FBI. Indeed, the FBI tracked virtually every move of Martin Luther King. CNN reported in an interview with author David Garrow that the FBI began secretly tracking King's flights and watching his associates. In July 1963, a month before the March on Washington, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover filed a request with Attorney General Robert Kennedy to tap King's and his associates' phones and to bug their homes and offices. In September, Kennedy consented to the technical surveillance. Kennedy gave the FBI permission to break into King's office and home to install the bugs, as long as agents recognized the delicacy of this particular matter and didn't get caught installing them. Kennedy added a proviso. He wanted to be personally informed of any pertinent information. President Kennedy even had installed a secret recording system in the Oval Office and Cabinet Room as well. He personally ordered Secret Service agent Robert Bauck to undertake the task. In his book, The Tunnels, author Greg Mitchell wrote, three previous presidents had installed listening devices, but they had used them sparingly. Franklin Roosevelt made a few recordings in 1940. Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower left behind less than a dozen hours of tapes each. Kennedy's plan would give him far more opportunity than that. JFK aimed to document face-to-face conversations with aides and visitors for his own use and/or the historical record. Without telling anyone why, at Kennedy's discretion, he installed the Oval Office microphones under the president's desk and in a coffee table. Kennedy could activate them with a discreet push of a button on his desk. The microphones in the cabinet room were hidden behind drapes and could be turned on and off by a button at the head of the table where Kennedy sat. Widespread domestic espionage and tax investigations only got worse under Kennedy's successor, President Lyndon Johnson. Like several of his predecessors, but even more so, Johnson used the IRS and the FBI as well as the CIA for unconstitutional and unlawful purposes. For example, the Heritage Foundation's Lee Edwards, who had served as Director of Information for the 1964 Barry Goldwater presidential campaign, tells how Johnson used the CIA and FBI to spy on the Goldwater campaign. Former intelligence officer E. Howard Hunt, best known for his role as an orchestrator in the Watergate bugging, wrote Edwards, told a Senate committee in 1973 that his CIA superior ordered him to infiltrate the Goldwater campaign. Hunt claimed to have questioned the order, only to be told that it had been a personal request of President Johnson and that the information he received would be delivered to a White House aide. CIA Director William Colby confirmed the White House's role in the illegal surveillance while addressing a congressional hearing in 1975. That the CIA is prohibited by law from operating within the U.S. didn't matter to the Johnson campaign. The Goldwater people never suspected that one of them was a spy for the Democrats. Edwards explained that the FBI arranged for widespread wiretapping of the Goldwater campaign. Sure enough, campaign reporters could soon be heard asking specific questions about the candidate's travel plans that had only been discussed by Goldwater aides behind closed doors. To protect themselves, Goldwater staffers began using payphones outside their headquarters. Johnson also illegally ordered the FBI to conduct security checks of Goldwater's Senate staff. In 1971, Robert Mardian, who had been regional director in the Goldwater campaign, became Assistant Attorney General for Internal Security. During a two-hour briefing with J. Edgar Hoover, Mardian asked about the procedures for electronic surveillance. To Mardian's amazement, Hoover confessed that in 1964 the FBI had wired the Goldwater campaign plane under orders from the White House. When Mardian asked Hoover why he had complied, the director answered, "You do what the president tells you to do." The focus of Johnson's espionage was not just his presidential opponent, but his own Democratic Party convention months before, when he feared the Kennedys might challenge his legitimacy, and he wanted complete control of the process. Hence, Johnson called in the FBI to surveil his own party's convention. As Professor Robert Dalek, author of Flawed Giant, Lyndon Johnson and His Times, 1961 to 1973, explains, to keep track of Robert Kennedy's doing and bottle him up, Johnson asked the FBI to send a team of men to Atlantic City. Ostensibly, the 30 agents assigned to the squad were to assist the Secret Service in protecting President Johnson and to ensure that the convention itself would not be marred by civil disruption. The then Attorney General Robert Kennedy knew nothing of this, nor was he the only subject of the FBI's monitoring. For 7 days, writes Dalek, the squad kept the White House apprised of all major developments during the convention's course. Using informant coverage, various confidential techniques, a wiretap on Martin Luther King's hotel room, and a microphone surveillance of the SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, and infiltration of key groups through the use of undercover agents and agents using appropriate cover as reports, FBI Deputy Kartha DeLoach provided Walter Jenkins, one of Johnson's top cronies, with 44 pages of intelligence data and kept Jenkins and Bill Moyers, another top Johnson crony, constantly advised by telephone of minute-to-minute developments. In fact, Dalek writes that when Vice President Hubert Humphrey would later receive the Democratic Party's nomination for president in 1968, to keep close tabs on the inner workings of Hubert's campaign, Johnson had the FBI tap Humphrey's phones. If Humphrey were going to come out against the Vietnam War, Johnson wanted advance notice and a chance to dissuade him. Johnson also put the IRS to maximum political use. Burnham observed that during the Johnson administration, the focus of the IRS's never-acknowledged effort at political control swung from the right wing to individuals and organizations concerned with racial matters or with opposing the U.S. presence in Vietnam. Unlike the Kennedy period, no evidence has yet emerged that directly links President Johnson to what became increasingly frenetic efforts by the FBI and the IRS to defang and declaw the critics of his administration. However, not too much should be made of this lack of documentary evidence. On January 1, 1967, Cartha DeLoach, J. Edgar Hoover's deputy, wrote a memorandum to Hoover stating that the White House had informed him that the president does not want any record made that would prove his direct involvement in FBI intelligence operations directed at war critics. The record contains a great deal of information, however, proving that the IRS, the FBI, and several other federal agencies were involved in a large number of such projects during the years that LBJ occupied the White House. Johnson also outdid Kennedy in secretly recording discussions in the White House. Dalek explains that the record of Johnson's presidency hardly suggests a man who was fastidious about constitutional guarantees of privacy or excessive government intrusion into private conversations and behavior. During his 5+ years in office, Johnson secretly recorded over 10,000 conversations without the knowledge of other parties on the telephone or in his White House offices. As the Democratic Party press has extensively reported for decades, President Richard Nixon and his administration used the various federal investigative, enforcement, and security agencies to harass, monitor, and deter political and policy opponents. And Nixon famously used the taping system in the Oval Office as well. However, in Nixon's case, unlike his predecessors, he faced real consequences for these activities. In July 1974, the House Judiciary Committee charged Nixon with various impeachable acts, including abuse of power, in Article II. It stated in part, "Using the powers of the Office of President of the United States, Richard M. Nixon, in violation of his constitutional oath, faithfully to execute the office of President of the United States and to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and in disregard of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, has repeatedly engaged in conduct violating the constitutional rights of citizens, impairing the due and proper administration of justice and the conduct of lawful inquiries, or contravening the laws governing agencies of the executive branch and the purpose of these agencies." In Section 1 of this charge, Nixon is said to have acted personally and through his subordinates and agents endeavored to obtain from the Internal Revenue Service in violation of the constitutional rights of citizens confidential information contained in income tax returns for purpose not authorized by law, and to cause, in violation of the constitutional rights of citizens, income tax audits or other income tax investigations to be initiated or conducted in a discriminatory manner. In Section 2, Nixon is said to have misused the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Secret Service, and other executive personnel in violation or disregard of the constitutional rights of citizens, by directing or authorizing such agencies or personnel to conduct or continue electronic surveillance or other investigations for purposes unrelated to national security, the enforcement of laws, or any other lawful function of his office. He did direct, authorize, or permit the use of information obtained thereby for purposes unrelated to national security, the enforcement of laws, or any other lawful function of his office. And he did direct the concealment of certain records made by the Federal Bureau of Investigation of Electronic Surveillance. Post-Nixon, the most egregious abuse of power involving the politicization of the IRS occurred during the Obama administration, when hundreds of Tea Party groups were targeted by the IRS. Some were investigated, some were audited, and some had their tax-exempt status questioned or applications for tax-exempt status delayed. President Obama had denied any knowledge of the IRS's activities, and ultimately he dismissed the scandal as phony. In a December 2013 interview with MSNBC's Chris Matthews, Obama said in part, "If you've got an office in Cincinnati, in the IRS office that I think for bureaucratic reasons is trying to streamline what is a difficult law to interpret about whether a nonprofit is actually a political organization, deserves a tax-exempt agency. And they've got a list, and suddenly everybody's outraged. After initial attention and curiosity, most newsrooms and journalists lost interest as well. Their attitude can best be summed up by far-left website Salon's political reporter Alex Seitz-Wald, who wrote on July 9, 2013, "The first few days of the IRS scandal that would consume Washington for weeks went like this. Conservatives were indignant, the media was outraged, the president had to respond, his allies turned on him. And only then, the Treasury Department's Inspector General released the actual report that had sparked the whole controversy, in that order. It's a fitting microcosm of the entire saga, which has gone from legacy-tarnishing catastrophe to historical footnote in the intervening 6 weeks, and a textbook example of how the scandal narrative can dominate Washington and cable news even when there is no actual scandal." Ironically, Bill Moyers, among President Johnson's most reliable and effective hatchet men, was so impressed with Seitz-Wald's piece that he posted it on his own website. In October 2017, as reported by Stephen Dinnan of The Washington Times, the Trump administration agreed Thursday to pay $3.5 million to Tea Party groups snared by IRS targeting during the Obama administration, saying the intrusive scrutiny was illegal and cannot be allowed to happen again. The government also reversed its tune on former IRS senior executive Lois G. Lerner. Instead of being a hero who tried to stop the targeting, as the Obama administration concluded in 2015, the Justice Department and IRS now say she failed to stop her employees and hid the bad behavior from her bosses for 2 years. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who announced the settlements, offered an apology to more than 450 groups that were part of 2 lawsuits against the IRS. As part of the agreements, the government admitted that the IRS forced Tea Party groups into illegal delays and unconscionable scrutiny, including questions about their political beliefs, plans to run for office, and names of financial backers. Rather than recognizing that the Trump administration earnestly acted to right a very serious wrong involving an abuse of power by the IRS during the Obama administration, the reaction from most of the mass media was a collective and cynical yawn. Moreover, there is not a hint that President Trump or his administration have illegally used the IRS, FBI, or CIA, as did several earlier presidents and administrations. Character. Whatever President Trump may or may not have done in his personal life before becoming president, which has been of intense interest to the Democratic Party press, there has not been any credible glimmer of moral improbity or faithlessness during his service in the Oval Office. Not so with several of his more recent predecessors, John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson tops among them, which was ignored by the mass media. President Kennedy had scores of extramarital flings and affairs both before and while he was president, with actresses, secretaries, married women, friends, a mobster's girlfriend, etc. Perhaps two of the most concerning such instances involved an alleged East German spy and a 19-year-old intern. As Professor Larry Sabato details, in July 1963, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover informed Bobby Kennedy that he knew about the president's past relationship with an alleged East German spy named Ellen Romich. The wife of an army officer who had been assigned to the West German embassy, Romich supplemented her income by turning tricks for Washington's best and brightest. Her pimp was a high-profile Senate aide named Bobby Baker, who had close ties to Lyndon Johnson. In late August 1963, Romich was flown back to Germany on a U.S. Air Force transport plane at the behest of the State Department. According to author Seymour Hersh, she was accompanied by Laverne Duffy, one of Bobby Kennedy's colleagues from his days on the McClellan Committee. Records related to Romich's deportation have either vanished or were never created in the first place. Then there was Kennedy's seduction of a young intern who had just arrived at the White House. The well-supported story of Mimi Alford, writes Sabato, a 19-year-old White House intern at the time of her involvement with JFK, is impossible to overlook. Initiated into JFK's sexual world just 4 days into her internship, Alford lost her virginity to Kennedy as he conducted what can only be called a deeply inappropriate affair with a young charge. It even included a Kennedy-directed episode of oral sex with aide Dave Powers while Kennedy watched. This behavior, barely hidden from others within the White House and involving government resources to shuttle Alford to and from the traveling president, has caused some to question Kennedy's basic fitness for the highest office. Many have tried to reconcile JFK's high-minded, skilled public persona with his sleazy, reckless private self. It is simply impossible to match up the two sides rationally, and it is certainly inadequate to say that the rules of his time or a sometimes empty marriage permitted or justified these escapades. Any private citizen with modest responsibilities would be condemned for them, and as president, JFK risked his White House tenure, the welfare of his party, his policy goals, and everyone he supposedly held dear. Lyndon Johnson was no better. Dalek writes that, although Johnson had a reverential regard for the presidency, he didn't see his personal crudeness as demeaning the office. As throughout his Senate and vice presidential years, he remained an exhibitionist and a philanderer who didn't mind flaunting his conquests. When a woman reporter at a private session with several journalists asked him a tough question, he reached down and pulled his crotch and said, "Well, I don't know." And he was scratching himself. It was terrible. During his vice presidency, the press called his Senate office the Nookie Room. He wanted beautiful women working for him and viewed them as fair game. Lady Bird shut her eyes and ears to some of this behavior. What she didn't know or acknowledge preserved her from painful offenses. Next, Dalek makes his salient point when it comes to the press. Almost all of Johnson's outrageous personal behavior was hidden from the public. In the 60s, journalists largely kept their knowledge of presidential transgressions of the sort Johnson committed to themselves. And not just because current mores dictated such journalistic restraint. Reporters and publishers who had been a partisan force against Goldwater were reluctant to undermine someone as progressive as LBJ. True, privately he was sometimes a Neanderthal whose crudeness offended them. But in public, he was an unflinching advocate of social reforms that promised large improvements in the lives of all Americans, particularly minorities and women. Of course, this goes a long way in explaining the disparate media treatment Kennedy and Johnson received vis-a-vis Trump. Kennedy and Johnson were both Democrats and both progressives. In particular, Johnson launched the Great Society, the greatest expansion of federal welfare programs and entitlements since Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Moreover, Kennedy and Johnson had defeated Republican candidates who were much hated by the media, Richard Nixon and Barry Goldwater, respectively. While the Democratic Party press turned on Johnson over the Vietnam War, they did much to protect his private life and Kennedy's from public scrutiny. Although President Bill Clinton did not receive the kind of kid gloves media treatment enjoyed by Kennedy and Johnson in their extramarital affairs while serving as president, it was Matt Drudge who broke the Monica Lewinsky story that Newsweek spiked at the last moment. As Drudge reported on January 17, 1998, "At the last minute, at 6 p.m. on Saturday evening, Newsweek magazine killed a story that was destined to shake official Washington to its foundation. A White House intern carried on a sexual affair with the President of the United States." The Drudge Report has learned that reporter Michael Isikoff developed the story of his career only to have it spiked by top Newsweek suits hours before publication. A young woman, 23, sexually involved with the love of her life, the President of the United States, since she was a 21-year-old intern at the White House. She was a frequent visitor to a small study just off the Oval Office where she claims to have indulged the President's sexual preference. Reports of the relationship spread in White House quarters, and she was moved to a job at the Pentagon, where she worked until last month. Ironically, several years ago, it was Isikoff that found himself in a shouting match with editors who were refusing to publish even a portion of his meticulously researched investigative report that was to break Paula Jones. Isikoff worked for the Washington Post at the time and left shortly after the incident to build them for the paper's sister magazine, Newsweek. There were also serious questions raised about NBC's reporting on rape allegations against Clinton dating to the time when he was Attorney General of Arkansas. As Breitbart reported, after filming the 1999 interview with Juanita Broderick by correspondent Lisa Myers, NBC waited 35 days until finally airing the exclusive. The timeline is critical. The Senate voted to acquit Clinton in the impeachment case on February 12th. NBC's interview, conducted January 20, 1999, did not run until February 24, and the network placed it opposite the highly rated Grammy Awards. Although NBC denied any nefarious motive in delaying the show's airing, some have questioned NBC's motivation in waiting to air Broderick's charge of rape. The 35-day interval between tape and air is now one of the legends of the impeachment process. Why didn't the American public get to hear Mrs. Broderick before the Senate voted to acquit Mr. Clinton on February 12th, wrote Philip Weiss in The Observer in 1999? Compare these examples not only to the press coverage received by President Trump, but the tawdry reporting surrounding the confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh for Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. As was reported by news outlets, Kavanaugh was accused of exposing himself, participating in drugging and gang-raping girls, raping a woman on a boat, being in a bar fight, drinking heavily in high school, and committing perjury, among other things. Kavanaugh, a sitting federal appellate judge, had two strikes against him. He was nominated by President Trump, and he was widely considered, rightly or wrongly, another originalist vote on the Supreme Court should he be confirmed. Therefore, the Democratic Party press abandoned all professional journalistic standards in a failed but disgraceful spectacle in assisting Senate Democrats to destroy Kavanaugh's character and prevent his confirmation.
Epilogue. A standardless profession. In the days leading up to and during the American Revolution, the patriots who ran the printing presses and produced the pamphlets and newspapers were intent on establishing a nation founded on Republican ideals of liberty, private property rights, representative government, freedom of speech, etc. They were open and transparent about their purpose. Indeed, they were often leaders in the revolutionary cause, making the intellectual, emotional, and factual arguments for independence. Later, the party press, in which newspapers aligned publicly with political parties and candidates, made no bones about their intentions. Newspapers and newsmen were advocates for a particular party, candidate, or policy, and were clear about their allegiances. At the turn of the last century, during the rise of the progressive movement, the mass media claimed to desire a scientific and professional approach to news gathering and reporting, one centered on objectivity, and they sought to distance themselves from the identity media. But even the idea and definition of objectivity became a point of debate and dispute, and remains so today. The word objective itself, and its application to the news, is used in a way that overlooks or excuses a news outlet's or reporter's overt fidelity to ideological progressivism and Democratic Party partiality. The contention is that the vetting of the news requires objective uniformity and standards, not the person or newsroom themselves. Consequently, in the last 100 years or so, the attitude has been that journalists need not be objective in their own thinking or politics, or seek objectivity in their own thinking or politics, as long as they are objective in their analytical method of gathering and reporting the news. Turning again to Bill Kovach and Tom Rosenstiel and their book, The Elements of Journalism, they make the point this way. A stronger, more unified, and more transparent method of verifying the news would be the single most important step that those who practice journalism could take to address and, if necessary, correct the rising perception that the work of journalists is marred by bias. What would this journalism of objective method rather than aim look like? What should citizens expect from the press as a reasonable discipline of reporting? Kovach and Rosenstiel provide 5 intellectual principles of a science of reporting. 1. Never add anything that was not there. 2. Never deceive the audience. 3. Be as transparent as possible about your methods and motives. 4. Rely on your own original reporting. And finally, 5. Exercise humility. However, it is quite clear that this interpretation of objectivity, while seemingly alluring, has proved impossible for most newsrooms and journalists. The reason is that most partisans are unable or unwilling to put aside their personal ideological and political perspectives, or even worse, they consider them essential to moving and improving society through activism. This is the fundamental nature of the modern media. For the most part, the objectivity of methods has become the partisanship of ideological and political results. The examples of ideologically and politically motivated stories are voluminous, and they lead to flat-out media fabrications and deceit. A few of the most notorious recent examples include the Rolling Stone story, defaming a University of Virginia dean in a false campus rape story, the false allegations of rape against members of the Duke lacrosse team, Dan Rather's discredited report about George W. Bush's military record, the smear of Brett Kavanaugh, the smear of the Covington Catholic students, and the seemingly endless list of false reports about President Trump, including collusion, and on and on. In 1897, Adolph S. Ox, the owner of the New York Times, created the famous slogan, "All the news that's fit to print." It still appears on the masthead of the newspaper today. He wrote the slogan as a declaration of the newspaper's intention to report the news impartially. But the Times, which is considered the gold standard of journalism by other newsrooms and journalists, and a guide star for news stories and leads, has a wretched history of deceit and untruthfulness, virtually unmatched by any other news organization. Having botched miserably the coverage of Adolf Hitler's genocide against the Jews and Joseph Stalin's genocide against the Ukrainians, either of which should have forever tainted the integrity and reliability of the Times, today it self-servingly and arrogantly portrays itself as leading the collective media rampart for freedom of the press. Yet is not the newspaper a well-known bastion of progressivism, which frequently distorts its reporting? And do not such misrepresentations about its true purpose pervert the role and purpose of journalism in a free press? Circumspection is not the media's strong point. And rather than clean up their act with serious self-policing by reforming their practices and standards, the Times and other media outlets pound their chests with self-righteous adoration as they proclaim themselves the defenders of a free press. As recently as February 20, 2019, current Times publisher Arthur Gregg Sulzberger, Ox's great-great-grandson, responding to President Trump referring to the newspaper as the enemy of the people, as the president was frustrated with yet another news story, this time an investigative report filled with allegations and innuendos about him and his administration from anonymous sources, publicly lectured the president and the nation about the importance of a free press. He wrote, "America's founders believed that a free press was essential to democracy because it is the foundation of an informed, engaged citizenry. That conviction, enshrined in the First Amendment, has been embraced by nearly every American president. Thomas Jefferson declared, 'The only security of all is in a free press.' John F. Kennedy warned about the risks to a free society without a very, very active press. Ronald Reagan said, 'There's no more essential ingredient than a free, strong, and independent press to our continued success.'" All these presidents had complaints about their coverage and at times took advantage of the freedom every American has to criticize journalists. But in demonizing the free press as the enemy, simply for performing its role of asking difficult questions and bringing uncomfortable information to light, President Trump is retreating from a distinctly American principle. It's a principle that previous occupants of the Oval Office fiercely defended, regardless of their politics, party affiliation, or complaints about how they were covered. The phrase "enemy of the people" is not just false, it's dangerous. It has an ugly history of being wielded by dictators and tyrants who sought to control public information. And it is particularly reckless coming from someone whose office gives him broad powers to fight or imprison the nation's enemies. As I have repeatedly told President Trump face to face, there are mounting signs that this incendiary rhetoric is encouraging threats and violence against journalists at home and abroad. Through 33 presidential administrations across 167 years, the New York Times has worked to serve the public by fulfilling the fundamental role of the free press. To help people, regardless of their backgrounds or politics, understand their country and the world. To report independently, fairly, and accurately. To ask hard questions. To pursue the truth wherever it leads. That will not change. Despite this deprecatory and hyperbolic statement against the president, who simply dared to harshly condemn the Times and its reporting, it is a fact that the Times frequently does not pursue the truth wherever it leads. And this is certainly true today in its coverage of the Trump presidency, where it has been predictably and aggressively hostile. Indeed, former ABC News anchor and longtime journalist Ted Koppel, no Trump supporter or conservative, expressed his profound concern about the state of journalism and particularly reporting at the Times during a March 7, 2019 discussion with Marvin Kalb at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He stated in part, "We have things appearing on the front page of the New York Times right now that never would have appeared 50 years ago. Analysis, commentary on the front page. I remember sitting at the breakfast table with my wife during the campaign after the Access Hollywood tape came out and the New York Times. I will not offend any of you here by using the language, but you know exactly what words they were, and they were spelled out on the front page of the New York Times." So President Trump's perception that the establishment press is out to get him doesn't mean that great journalism is not being done. It is. But the notion that most of us look upon Donald Trump as being an absolute fiasco, he's not mistaken in that perception, and he's not mistaken when so many of the liberal media, for example, describe themselves as belonging to the resistance. What does that mean? That's not said by people who consider themselves reporters, objective reporters. That's the kind of language that's used by people who genuinely believe, and I rather suspect with some justification, that Donald Trump is bad for the United States, and they're betting that the sooner he's out of office, the better they will like it. Whether that happens by virtue of indictment, impeachment, or election, we'll see. We are not the reservoir of objectivity I think we were. However, rather than accept responsibility for the low credibility in which the Times and other media outlets are held by the public as a consequence of their own record and behavior, the Times and many other newsrooms conveniently blame President Trump for the distrust and cynicism they themselves have sowed with the citizenry. As discussed earlier, unlike certain of the president's predecessors, Trump has taken no official governmental steps to silence news organizations or journalists. Although Sulzberger mentioned Jefferson, Kennedy, and Reagan as defenders of the press despite their complaints about it, a group in which Trump should actually be included for these purposes, Sulzberger omits that Adams, Lincoln, Wilson, FDR, and Obama did in fact use the power of the federal government against news outlets and journalists with whom they disagreed. Sulzberger's rhetoric about Trump is dishonest and a deflection from his own failure as a newspaper publisher. Sulzberger is also less than forthcoming when describing the role of his journalists as truth seekers digging for the facts. In an April 25, 2004 opinion piece by the newspaper's public editor, Daniel Ockrent, the role of a journalist is described this way. "With very few exceptions, the longer you've been here or the higher you've risen in the organization, the less likely you are to believe the Times is or should be the paper of record. Metro columnist Clyde Haberman told me that in his 27 years at the Times, I've never heard anyone inside the paper refer to it that way. Reporter Richard Perez Pena, an 11-year veteran, said, I don't think I've ever heard my colleagues here use the phrase except rarely in an ironic, almost self-mocking tone. I think that's because they recognize both the impossibility of fulfilling the role and the deadening effect it could have on the paper. Catherine Boughton, deputy editor of the paper's Sunday magazine, said, We understand now that all reporting is selective. With the exception of raw, original source material, there really isn't anything of record, is there? Here's another way of stating it. In a heterogeneous world, whose record is one newspaper even in the position to preserve? And what group of individuals, no matter how talented or dedicated, would dare to arrogate to itself so godlike a role? If you rely on the Times as your only source of news, you're buying into the conceptions, attitudes, and interests of the people who put it out every day. It cannot be definitive, and asking it to be is a disservice to both the staff and the readers. I mean no disrespect to the Times, but what discriminating citizen can really afford to rely on only one source of news? Of course, Ockrent was right that news organizations like the Times have conceptions, attitudes, and interests of the people who put it out every day, which speaks to the Times' frequent and obvious interchangeable use of its news and editorial pages in service to the progressive ideology and the Democratic Party program, like so many media organizations these days. Moreover, he and the colleagues with whom he spoke acknowledged further that they are not in the business of simply reporting the news, for it would have a deadening effect on the newspaper. Thus, they neither seek nor deliver objectivity in their news reporting. Its role is news with social activism, agenda driving, interpretation, analysis, etc., as a siren for the progressive cause. Jim Rutenberg, a Times News correspondent turned columnist, is even more blunt. He asserts that if you are a journalist who despises Trump, as so many in the Democratic Party press do, and consider him some kind of a threat to the nation, you can hardly be expected to report objectively about him. On August 7, 2016, Rutenberg explained the mindset of the newspaper and the media at large, writing, "If you're a working journalist and you believe that Donald J. Trump is a demagogue playing to the nation's worst racist and nationalistic tendencies, that he cozies up to anti-American dictators, and that he would be dangerous with control of the United States nuclear codes, how the heck are you supposed to cover him? If you believe all of those things, you have to throw out the textbook American journalism has been using for the better part of the past half century, if not longer, and approach it in a way you've never approached anything in your career. If you view a Trump presidency as something that's potentially dangerous, then your reporting is going to reflect that. You would move closer than you've ever been to being oppositional. That's uncomfortable and uncharted territory for every mainstream, non-opinion journalist I've ever known, and by normal standards, untenable. But the question that everyone is grappling with is, do normal standards apply? And if they don't, what should take their place? It may not always seem fair to Mr. Trump or his supporters. But journalism shouldn't measure itself against any one campaign's definition of fairness. It is journalism's job to be true to the readers and viewers and true to the facts in a way that will stand up to history's judgment. To do anything less would be untenable. The abandonment of objective truth, and worse, the rejection of the principles and values of America's early press and revolutionaries, is not new for the Times. It long predates the Trump presidency, and it has led the Times and other media outlets into a very bleak and dark place, destructive of the press as a crucial institution for a free people. If newsrooms and journalists do not act forthwith and with urgency to fundamentally transform their approach to journalism, which sadly is highly unlikely, their credibility will continue to erode and may well reach a point soon where it is irreparably damaged with a large portion of the citizenry, and rightly so. The media will not only marginalize themselves, but they will continue to be the greatest threat to freedom of the press today. Not President Trump or his administration, but the current practitioners of what used to be journalism. Therefore, as I said at the opening, this book is intended to, among other things, jumpstart a long overdue and hopefully productive dialogue among the American citizenry on how best to deal with the complicated and complex issue of the media's collapsing role as a bulwark of liberty, the civil society, and republicanism. Acknowledgements. Writing a book is a family effort. It involves very long hours at all times of the day and night, including weekends and holidays. I am blessed to have a very tolerant and understanding family, starting with my amazing wife, Julie. She not only endures my crazy hours and the mood swings authors experience during the research and writing process, but she is an indispensable partner and sounding board for my thoughts and ideas. Julie is a brilliant lawyer in her own right, and she not only made this a better book, but she came up with the title. I cannot say enough about our wonderful children and grandchildren. Lauren, Chase, David, Jenna, Nick, Sloan, and Asher. They are outstanding human beings in every way and bring us much joy. I could not be prouder of each and every one of them. To my big brother, Doug, you are one of the most decent and kind people I have ever had the honor to know. You are an inspiration to everyone who knows you. and to our dear Sylvia of the Greatest Generation, whom we adore and who inspires all of us with her wisdom, energy, and kindness. Finally, I posthumously thank my beloved parents, Jack and Norma, who recently passed from this life to the next, just 4 months apart, and who will be forever together and loved in perpetuity by their family. So too Leo Strauss, who left an indelible mark on his children and grandchildren, and who will always be a shining light.
Unfreedom of the Press was written by Mark R. Levin and read by Jeremy Lowell, with the introduction and epilogue read by the author. It was recorded by David Evanoff at David Evanoff Sound Designs in Salt Lake City and John St. Denis at Magic Lantern in Atlanta. Editing, mix, and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Unfreedom of the Press was produced and directed by Paul Fowley. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Unfreedom of the Press is available in print from Threshold. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Rediscovering Americanism and the Tyranny of Progressivism, written by Mark R. Levin and read by Jeremy Lowell, with an introduction read by the author.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.